Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm really happy.
You look amazing in that sweatshirt. That's like multicoloured. You've got diagonal situations, geometric abstractions, shoulder pieces.
Well, I had to make an effort.
Why?
Because today's guest is someone that is just so visually inspiring that I have to like put something on. I've even got like, you know, an ex-boyfriend of mine hated this top so much. He thought it was like shoulder pads. And we went to a, I'm going to shame him right now.
Go on.
We went to...
Shoulder pad shame him.
The only time he ever actually introduced me to any of his friends was some mate of his got married. And I went to the party afterwards. And I was like, you know, I sort of turned up at like 8 p.m. after they were already drunk and had the whole wedding and everything. And I turned up wearing this and he took me to one side and was like, "What are you wearing? You have got shoulder pads on." I was literally like, "These aren't shoulder pads. They're pieces of fabric that are flat, like sewed onto
in the shoulder area."
In the shoulder area, and he was like, "You're embarrassing me."
Oh.
And that was when I knew it was the end of that relationship.
He didn't get fashion, did he?
He was just horrible. And now everyone knows how horrible you were.
So our guest is someone who is has been a stylist to the good and the great and knows everything about what it is to wear clothes.
Well, yeah, but you know what? She's so much more than that. And that's why she's such an incredible human being that has literally inspired me for many years now. And I would say in my life, there are probably five people that have made a huge impact on me. And she is one of those people.
Am I one of those people?
You are, actually.
Oh, great.
So I'm sat with two people who are in my top five ever.
Oh, my God.
And considering my mum is one of those five and my dad.
Is she here as well
that's
somewhere?
Pretty high up, guys. So lucky you.
Right.
So she's been described as a creative shapeshifter. She's a kind of cultural commentator, a poet, but primarily a multidisciplinary artist and now also a curator. And we will be inviting her back because she's actually going to be curating a show in Margate at our space, which will open in September.
Carl Friedman.
Yeah, at Carl Friedman Gallery. But we're not going to discuss that today because we have other things to discuss. And there's this amazing little comment from Ten magazine recently where a collaborator of hers, the photographer Jez Tozer, summed it all up, and I'm just going to read this quickly. "Zoe provides an extraordinary portal from the banality of the obvious material world into a magical, mystical one. She is one of life's conduits for learning and discovery." And I just thought that summed her up so much.
Amazing.
So we would like to welcome to Talk Art Zoe Badeau.
Hiya, Zoe.
Hey, guys. So glad to be here. Very nice.
What do you think of that introduction?
Yeah, it's good. Nice springboard.
What do you think of Rob's top?
Yeah, I'm loving it. I love it. You know what? I love anything that has diamonds in it because I'm obsessed by Harlequins. So.
You are?
Yeah, so that for me is a very kind of quite, yeah, that's quite...
How does a diamond relate to a Harlequin?
Well, the suit that the Harlequin wears is diamonds. It's all diamonds.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I call them diamond gods. They're keepers of the universe for me, the Harlequins. I have them in all my spaces, everywhere in my house. In every room, there's a Harlequin.
Where do the Harlequins come from?
The Harlequins, they're keepers of the invisible realm. They don't really come from anywhere. They're just, you know, they're self-manifested.
But when did they appear in, like, art?
In art? Well, they kind of appeared in art. Well, really, Picasso was the one... from my knowledge, that really sort of promoted the Harlequin. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In the early sort of 20th century, early 1900s, he started depicting them in paintings. Right up to 1918, he was doing them when he was in the more cubist, he did sort of cubistic period.
Yeah.
Period. He did more kind of abstractions of the Harlequin, but the early ones, in the Harlequin with glass or the two acrobats, they're more sort of direct depictions of the Harlequin. But I love them. I'm asleep.
Where would he have seen them? Are they in circuses?
Well, they're in circuses. Circuses. And the Harlequin, you know, very, you know, in Italy. It's a clown. It's a particular one with the diamonds.
Yeah.
But in Italy, very big, the Harlequin, and in France.
When I was a kid, I was obsessed with puppets of like Piero.
Oh, you know the Piero, yeah, the white. Kind of sad, with the,
yeah,
it's a bit sad, that one.
Yeah, but I really was
always
drawn
had
to
sort
it.
Of a teardrop.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, it was simply crying.
I've always been a bit of a drama queen ever since I was like 4 years old.
Yeah.
When I used to do
ballet. I find the Harlequin's a bit more upbeat.
Yeah. But also, there's an amazing painting. Russell and I came for dinner at your house not long ago, and there's an amazing painting in your kitchen of a Harlequin, which is part of your incredible collection of objects and art.
Yeah, I've got them everywhere, the Harlequin.
Who painted that one? Can you remember? I love that. Wasn't it a female painter?
Oh, yes. You know what's so funny? That's a friend of mine, Sophie, who did that. And it's not actually a Harlequin, but I bought it because it's very Harlequin-esque.
Yeah.
It's like she's got a mask face and then the body of the top torso bit looks... She's just kind of put that in. It's that's why I bought that. I love it. It's really great.
So actually, let's start there. Because when we came to your house, I mean, I've been there many times recently, but you have an incredible collection of all kinds of objects and art. You've got beautiful paintings and also like collages over the wall where you've got like everything from images of like Grace Jones to like early, I don't know, fashion shoots and all kinds of things. Like,
yeah, the montage is just like things that I rip out. I always like to have a nice kind of
thing, but
what people call mood boards. But I mean, I just call it, it's just like a collage. It's just like a backdrop of my life, really, in a way. Just things that I've seen. It can be an Irving Penn, you know, picture of food. It can be anything. Just to catch my... I just cut out little bits. I'm always ripping bits out of magazines.
Yeah.
I used to collect magazines. I don't anymore. But, I mean, I've just got hordes of them and I just rip pages out and I stick them up and just, you know... it's just inspiring.
Have you always had that kind of urge to collect things?
Yeah, since I was a kid, the first thing I ever collected was stones.
Really?
Yeah,
I wanted semi-precious stones, or
any semi-precious and any kinds of stones. The first stones I was really attracted to were agate and agate. My aunt had an agate ring, and I was obsessed with it because the agate was still growing in the ring, and I became obsessed by crystals and stones. I was really young, and my mum got me an agate ring, I think for my 7th birthday or something, and I collected stones. I lived in the countryside, and where I lived was sort of an old, you know, Romans sort of area in Hertfordshire. And there was like pudding stones. So I was always digging in the garden. I wanted to be an archaeologist. And I am a kind of archaeologist because I'm always digging. I'm very sort of like the predator hunting, looking for something in whatever it is. I'm kind of obsessed with the hunt and the excavation of something. Do you know what I mean? That's why I'm really enjoying the curating, because it's really great sort of delving in and finding, especially when you're looking at something very specific as what I'm looking for materially for that exhibition that I'm doing for you guys. It's just very interesting of just finding people that you don't know about and just uncovering treasure. Do you know what I mean? That's what's really...
But there's always a knock-on effect when you find one artist you think you know and then you see their references or their inspirations and you're like, I didn't even know about this person.
Oh, yeah, no, it just opens up a whole world. You know, the estuaries are endless. Do you know what I mean? You just keep going off into different worlds, and that's what's really great about that. Do you know what I mean?
Who's your go-to then, artist-wise, like... who you look at? You said Picasso just now, you said Irving Penn as the photography-wise, but, I mean, for you, like, to find ideas for your creations?
No, I don't really have a go-to artist because I'm not really looking at artists in that way, do you know what I mean? The art, to me, is the end point. I'm looking at more things, you know, I'm looking at nature, do you know what I mean? That's the greatest artistry for me. So that's my starting point. I'm looking from that. And then from there, from when I'm looking at culturally, I look at indigenous cultures. I've always had that as a kind of, wherever I go in the world, I always go to where the indigenous people are. I'm always very much interested in the kind of archaic, you know, when you look, and when I look at art and you think about modern art even, you know, what was the turning point of modern art? For Picasso, it was looking at those African masks. Without him seeing those masks, or those masks being available to artists in the Eurocentric world, it would not have developed. You know, Cubism would not have been what it is. We would never have had those movements. Do you know what I mean? And for me, it's important to recognise the etymology, where things have come from, what has been the point of inspiration. Do you know what I mean? And so for me, the archaic world, you know, Africa particularly, is very close to my heart, in the sense when I look at these things out there, the masks, just the work, the embroidery, you know, the handwork that comes out of there. It's just, it's so archaic, but at the same time, it's so sublime and totally modern. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
These pieces just transcend time. Mm. You take them out of any place and you're just thinking, wow, when was that made? Do you know what I mean? It's just beyond. Yeah, right. And that for me is the inspiration. That's where it comes from. And then you see the kind of ripple effects of how it's inspired things on a greater scale. But, and also, you know, what's interesting is that people don't normally hark back to the original because they don't know. Do you know what I mean? They don't know where it's come from. Yeah, so they just take what is seen, and especially as we're in the centre of the world where, you know, everything in the West is seen as the original form. No one goes into the archival history of stuff unless it's been brought to them. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's important. And that's, I think, what really great curating is about. You know, you can do it, you can curate something and you can have lots of artists. But I think it's also interesting within that curation to actually reveal sources where, you know, you can have a group show, say, and you've got loads of different artists and you might have an artist in there that isn't known.
Mm. Yeah.
But when you go to see that show, you'll see the thread that unknown artist has influenced the ones that are known and actually have got greater recognition for that work.
Yeah.
And that's what's important to me.
Mm. Yeah.
That people can say, oh, wow, this one was doing that then, and then this is done only like 5 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Surely there must be some cross because this work is so original. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Someone must have had to have, you know what I mean? And that's what's interesting to me.
Wow. Do you think that's quite sad then that unknown artist didn't get the plaudits that the person that's kind of slightly ripped
off? No, because I think in the show, within that show, is where that person gets that
celebration.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that should be celebrated, that person gets that kind of recognition.
Yeah.
You know, and it depends on the artist as well. Not everyone's actually creating art for recognition. And that's where we have to really sort of differentiate artistic practices because, you know, in the Japanese Edo period, there was a group of philosophers and it was about to-doing. It wasn't about what you got from doing.
Exactly.
You just did it. You know, I create because that is what I'm here to do. Whether you recognise it or not is irrelevant to me because when you're autonomous in your being and what you're doing, it's not about other people. You can't validate what I'm doing. I validate what I'm doing. Do you know what I mean? So if you then, you know, enjoy it, appreciate it, respect the work, understand it, that's a bonus. Mm. Do you know what I mean? That is a bonus. But when people are doing something for the recognition, it more the work becomes irrelevant almost because it's not about the work. It's about what do I get from the work? Do you know what I mean? What does that work bring to me? And you see it so much now, it's just like, hello, what is this really about?
Yeah.
You know, so when you see artists and they're just creating, you can really see when people are just in their practice and it's just like, you know what? I do this because this is what I'm here to do. I don't know about doing it. I can't do anything else, you know?
Right. People have been making art for years without a commercial market.
Yeah, exactly. And then if they get recognised, it's like, great. But, you know, do they recognise themselves? Mm. That's the important question. Mm. Do you recognise yourself? Mm. Because people who recognise themselves recognise others. And I find that people who are looking for the applause rarely applause others because they're looking for it. Do you know what I mean? It's not a genuine exchange, you know? When you go out there, I want to applaud people. I want to applaud things that I think are great. If I see someone on the street and they look really great and they're inspiring, I go up to them. And, you know, you make someone's day. Do you know what I mean? For me, there's day make, you know, you can make someone's day and you can break someone's day. You know what I mean? By, you know, just being whatever, you know those people, they break the day. They're just like, it's just unnecessary. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, really? You know, and you can make someone's day and just be like, you know, I see little old ladies and they look fabulous. I'm just like a pink scarf or just a touch of something. You just think, oh my God, you look fabulous. You're so uplifting. This is great. You're 85 and you're still, do you know what I mean? You've
still got it
and you're still feeling vibrant.
So you'll go up to them and be like,
oh, babe, I stop people all the time.
That's so cool.
I mean, I did a whole project with this woman in Brighton. I mean, she was amazing, called Yvonne. She was like in her 70s.
Yeah.
This one was in high heels, bit of fur, red lipstick. And I shot her for ID magazine. She was amazing. I mean, she was so inspiring. Went to her house and just like, she was still like, in her mind, she was like 25.
Love that.
Do you know what I mean?
Where did you see her? Where did you find her?
I first saw her in Brighton walking down the street, Gardner Street. I never forget it. And she had high heels on. The shoes had fallen apart and they were taped up with gaffer tape, right? They were like patent leather with a bit of gaffer tape taped onto them. So
she
had a fur coat on and this beautiful sequined hat. And I just went up to her. I was like, you look amazing. She's like, oh, hello, love. She's from the East End. She grew up in pubs. She's fabulous. And so I went to her house. I even got someone to come down and photograph her. I mean, she was coming on to the photographer. I mean, it was insane. She even tracked him down and started to stalk him.
Oh, wow.
No, it all got a bit weird. But anyway, she was really kind of fabulous. I mean, that was, yeah, it was quite interesting. But she was really quite a buoyant, uplifting character.
Is she still around, do you know?
I don't know.
Keep your distance, did you?
I mean, no. She was, that's got to be 10 years ago. And she was... She must have been nearing 80. She might have been old. I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about it the other day, thinking, I wonder if she's still alive.
But the injunction's still going, right?
So. Oh, my God. I mean, she was brilliant. She was top, honestly.
Can
amazing.
We talk about this then quickly? So in the late 80s, you sort of began working with a number of creative, incredible...
Oh, no, babe. I mean, I'm not that old. Late 80s, I was still at school.
Okay, early 90s. Early 90s.
I was still at school.
Early
90s. Make that really clear. People keep going to me about the 80s, and I'm like, babe,
you
weren't
there.
Was watching Dynasty in Dallas at home and Grange Hill. I was not
I love
on
Grange
any
Hill.
Scene.
Okay, so early 90s. Early 90s.
Early 90s.
You worked with people like Judy Blume.
Okay, let me tell you about how this started. Yeah. I was at school. I was an artist... At school, that was my thing. I was.
Where did you go?
And you
studied
art, didn't you?
Yeah, I studied art at Harrow. I went to school in the countryside in Hertfordshire, and a friend of mine, Pat, brought a magazine in that her dad had given to her. It was a very strange shaped magazine, and it was a fashion magazine, and it said ID on the cover. It's the first time I'd ever seen this magazine, and we opened it, and I was terrified. I was like, oh my God, who are these people? I mean, I remember being really terrified. And it was really weird that her dad had given her this magazine. He was in the army. It was just a bit of an odd situation. I was looking at this and I was properly scared. I remember it. And so we sort of closed it really quickly. We were just like, it's like opening, do you know what I mean?
Pandora's box, yeah.
You know, and then we closed it and we were like, oh my God, where do these people live? And it was like, you know, we opened it again. It was like all clubs in London. It was all this kind of, you know, this underbelly of this counterculture that hadn't quite reached Hertford, Hemel Hempstead.
And, it still hasn't. It's still making its way there.
It's still making its way there. And we were just like, and then from the kind of shock horror, the curiosity built. And then we started looking at other magazines and stuff. Do you know what I mean? It was like The Face, ID. They were the two magazines that we were looking at. I was really taken with the work of Ray Petrie and decided to write to him.
Wow.
So I wrote to Ray Petrie.
So who wrote Petrie?
Ray Petrie. No, he was a... I don't even know what they were called, stylists at this point in history.
Okay, right.
Image makers. And he was using models multiculturally, yeah, taking these guys, naming them all, and the photography was just so amazing, like nothing you'd seen, like beautiful portraits. The guys were amazing. A lot of the models from this agency called Marco Rosala, I really remember that. It was they had all the hot guys, do you know what I mean? And these pictures were incredible. And I was like, oh my God, I want to meet this man. I want to, because it was about representation at the time as well. Do you know what I mean? It was like, he had just models like, you know, they looked like they were, you know, South American, black, Indian. You know, it was a real cross the board culture. And it was just amazing. He had girls in there too, but it was mainly about these boys. And it was called Buffalo, the movement. It was like a movement.
Exactly.
Nothing to do with the shoes.
Nothing to do with those horrendous platform boots.
Spice
no.
Girl yeah. shoes.
Nothing
yeah.
to do with the Spice Girls.
No, nothing
this
to do with that.
This is way before.
That's way before.
And way more pioneering, in a different way.
But yeah, I wrote to him and the letter came back to me. Return to sender. He's no longer at this address.
He moved.
Exactly. He was no longer at this address. So I was a bit sad and everything. And what could I do? So I got the letter back. And then I came to London. I'd gone to Harrow. I was going to go to St. Martin. I thought I'd study journalism. And then in the summer, I got this job. I worked with actually Marisha Voronecka, fashion PR. She was very like the one in
London.
Wasn't
she the one who did like PR for kind of like Margiela and like,
she,
all
well,
the
she did
Antwerp.
All the on, and the Antwerp Six.
Yeah,
she did all of those guys, and she had a really
and that was
great
revolution.
Roster.
Right, Antwerp Six. Go yeah. who?
Antwerp Six. Okay,
Dries
who are
van
they?
Noten.
Ander Molemeester,
Bernard Wilhelm,
Bernard
was a bit later.
Yeah, Bernard was later. And what's his name with the made all the mad? You know, Baron. What's his name?
Oh yeah,
Bickenberg.
Walter Bickenberg. Oh, Bickenberg.
Dirk Bickenberg and yeah. Walter, the other one.
Stock.
Exactly him. And then who
Martin Margiela.
Was he in the Belgians? I thought he was.
Raph Simmons, was he part of that?
No, later. I can't remember if Margiela was in the six. I think he was a bit of a...
But is that a thing? They're known as the Belgium Six.
They were the Belgian Six. That's how they were packaged.
Oh, no, you're right. It was Marina Yee.
Yeah, that's it, Marina Yee.
And then Dirk Bickenberg.
Yeah, exactly.
Wouter von Beerendonk. Yeah. Dirk van Sana. And De Moylemeester.
Dries van Noten.
And Dries van Noten.
Yeah. Wow.
Exactly. They were the original six.
Yeah.
And then out of that, you had Margiela and Bernard and all of the other greats.
But yeah, so she had those guys and some English design and everything. And I was working with her as like a work experience. And she said, you know, Camilla Lowther was looking for a PA. So I went to have this interview with Camilla and got the job. And I became her PA, which was quite hilarious because I had to like, you know, she sent me on a Pittman's typing course. Do you know what I mean?
Wow, really?
She doesn't remember. She goes, did I send you? I goes, yes, darling.
Really?
Like, literally, Pittman's typing course every Thursday. I still can't type. It was a fucking disaster.
Pittman's reminds me of my mum because she ran a PR business. And I remember them all talking about having to do
Pittman's. Oh my God, it was just
awful.
How
old was you at this point?
At this point, I'm like...
Post-A-level.
19.
Okay.
Yeah, 19. I'm on this Pittman's course because I've got to do invoices as part of my job. And it's like, I couldn't type and it was just a disaster. Anyway, but what was amazing was I went to work with Camilla. She looked after photographers. And the photographers that she was looking after were people like Norman Watson, Mark Le Bon, Perry Ogden... And she had Judy Blame, stylist. And who else did she have? But what that was, a gateway into the world. So Mark Le Bon worked with Ray Petrie.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Norman Watson, all these guys. So it was everything that I was visualising in the magazine. All these people were then I was looking after.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? So I was like just immersed in this world. So it was really crazy. And it was the last years of Ray's life. So I met him. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
Because he was, I did a shoot. We produced one of his last shoots, which was an advertising shoot for Jockey Underwear. That was hilarious.
No way.
Anyway, yeah. And the first day of the shoot, I think they were stuck somewhere else and I was on the shoot. And then, I mean, it was hilarious. The client, there was no shoes. The client had to take off his shoes and use them for the job. I was calling Camilla going, we haven't got any shoes. The client's lending his shoes. I mean, it was so
Model's
crazy.
Own.
It could never happen today. Me and Camilla often look back and just laugh our socks off how crazy some of these shoots were. But it was very free time. It was very hilarious. You know, there seemed to be a lot of money within the industry floating around. In that time, there was a lot of money in the music industry, which there isn't now.
Yeah.
Not very much money in fashion, which is there's a reversal.
And also, there were a lot of musicians who sort of helped take the Buffalo look, didn't they,
yeah, exactly.
into music.
Naina Cherry
like
was,
Naina Cherry.
Exactly. Well, Naina was affiliated to Ray through Cameron McVeigh.
Right.
And Jamie Morgan, because they worked with him, you know, the photographers and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's where that came from. And so, yeah, so I was just then immersed in the world. So it was just quite ironic that I was terrified by that ID magazine.
Yeah.
And yet it was like this kind of crazy circus. And I actually joined that circus. Do you know what I mean? Through kind of then delving into it and just like the curiosity grew and stuff.
Fascination came from your fear.
Yeah, exactly. And then suddenly, because we'd never seen anything like that. I mean, people like dressed up. I mean, if you look at all the pictures from the 80s and stuff, the way people were dressed, we were just like, who are these people?
Yeah.
Where are they getting these outfits from? Do you know what I mean? It was just so amazing.
There was no rules. Suddenly.
There was no rules. Yeah. And there was that kind of thing, you know, necessity being the mother of all creation, that, you know, you don't have anything. You know, it was just, you know, these people that are just making stuff out of nothing. And that was what was amazing. And then I worked with Camilla as her, you know, like, I'm not an admin. You know, I was an artist, an art student.
Yeah.
And so then I went and worked with Judy. And then we went off and we were traveling all over doing shoots and whatever. But I was, you know, he was an artist, do you know what I mean? And that's why I was interested in his work, because of where he was coming from. It was never, I mean, that word stylist, I don't even know when it came into being a real thing. I do remember, the comedy, that comedy club that used to be, that set of five with Rick Mayall? They had this amazing...
Comic Strip Presents.
Comic Strip.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a brilliant episode of the Comic Strip where there is a stylist in one of the comic strips with UB40 in it. And it's the one where they get swapped. A skinhead gets swapped with sort of a new ager. It's genius.
Wow.
So this new ager becomes a skinhead and the skinhead becomes all new age. And it's, oh my God, we've got to find out what this one's got.
Yeah, we'll
it's
find it.
Really amazing. And there's a video being played. They're on a video set for UB40. a UB40 video is being shot, and there's a stylist in there. I'm sure it's based on Judy because they didn't really exist then. I remember the outfit. I mean, just remember that's Judy and the thing. And then there's this bit where the sort of new age guy, I think he's the art director on the thing, and he, because he's the skinhead, sort of NF.
Yeah.
He's now got that personality, and he goes to the camera pans. He goes, and can you not land on Sooty? And he goes, I mean, the guy with the... Do you understand? Because it's a black guy.
Oh, my God.
So it was hilarious, this comic strip one.
Amazing.
And I can't ever forget what the name of it, because they should bring those back. They were so good. Anyway, so I think in that they called...
I made one of them. They did bring it back.
Did they?
We did something called Red Top, which was about Rebecca Brooks, and I played Andy Coulson, and we did like a whole remake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's 2 years ago, yeah.
So I think they actually used the term stylist in there for this personality.
Right,
I think
right,
that's,
right.
You know... But, you know, he was really an artist, and that was what was interesting, because, you know, he did, like, you know, the early Massive Attack. He did all the album covers and stuff. He did Nena's album covers. Mm. And so it was just really interesting being immersed in that world. But I was never really in the fashion business, in the sense that I never had a book. Do you know what I mean? So people would say, can you send your book over? And I'd be like, I don't have one. And they'd be like, what do you mean you don't have one? I goes, well, I don't understand. The last job I did has got nothing to do with the next one.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want me, let's just see, let's have a conversation. We try it out and let's organically see if we can work together. And that's how I worked. Do you know what I mean? It was never, I just never really was enmeshed in that industry in that way.
The formalities of what it was.
Yeah, because I never came from that. And also, you know, the people I was working with, they were all just so kind of, they were so anarchic. Do you know what I mean? They were just like operating on the outskirts of all of that. Do you
totally,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Judy was like taking brands and chopping up their labels and mixing them up with stuff, you know, totally illegal things. You know, I did an interview where I said, you know, they were looking for Judy Blame. And they wrote a letter to ID magazine saying to give his, you know, give her details to them. I think it was Moët or it was Louis Vuitton. And the hilarious thing is, like, you know, Kim Jones goes to work at Louis Vuitton, and Judy then went to work at Vuitton.
Mm. Yeah.
So just that turnaround
so in
20 years, the turnaround of them wanting to take him to court for reappropriating, you know,
thinking he was a she,
bastardizing their brand.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 20 years later, he's working for them.
Yeah.
And that's at the point where fashion did have money, and it was all kind of, you know, luxury brands existed and everything. You know, it was just the whole landscape changed. It was all shifted. Because, you know, if you think about it, in shoots, we could use this, we could use anything, we'd turn up with whatever. And that was what was great, because you were creative, because you were looking and finding, you know, all the top magazines could get all the great stuff, but if you're doing independent, you always had to beg, borrow and steal to get something,
you're
shooting for ID.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Well, now everyone lends because it's established as a magazine, but then, so you had to really sort of fight to get those pages and get that whatever look you wanted. Now it's the complete reverse. Unless you're using advertisers, they're dictating what goes on the pages.
Yeah.
You can't just turn up and say, oh, I found this down the road, I just want to put it in. They'll be like, oh, no, you can't mix that with so-and-so. They don't want that in the picture. And so for me, when I was working and working with some, you know, working with Jürgen, my things were much more...
This is Jürgen Teller.
Yeah. Was curating. I would bring things that I would find and he didn't care. And because we were working in that vein, it was always like, I would always get a letter the day before shoot, and it would always say, you know, and if you could try and get a bit of Armani or Prada in on this one, but if you can't, don't worry, because I'd be like, well, I haven't got any of that, so I haven't ordered any of that in, I haven't called any of that in, it's not going to happen. My thing was always a bit about what I wanted. Do you know what I mean? I was never going to be dictated to buy clothes that I wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that was how the landscape had changed from when I started with these guys to then the present, which was just like the beginning of the end.
And actually, I feel like all the people that you have collaborated with, you know, we just mentioned Jürgen Teller, the fashion but also art photographer, like that. You the people you've collaborated with often aren't defined by being fashion, that they're not fashion.
Well, they're
actually creative artists, really.
Yeah, within this, and that's the whole point, is it's about the vision outside.
And the thing
that
I always liked about Jürgen's photography actually was the way the pictures were, that, you know, if you see the shoots you did with Kate Moss or these different people, like I've looked at them over the last few days, but they're the images that always struck me by him. And they're often the ones that you styled or you know, helped create the visual language in. And it is an art form, that. I mean, it's
Zoe's just trying to get something out of her pocket.
I forget the rustling. Oh my god, it reminds me of once. I mean, just to go right off piece, I was on the Jonathan Ross show. Oh my god, someone said, "Oh, you go on the John." I was like, "Yeah, to go on a quiz show."
Really?
And they mic'd me up, and I forgot that I had this mic there. And every question I was getting wrong. I mean, they would ask something about the Clangers. I'd never heard of the Clangers. They were on the question, and it was like the Clangers. And what you could win on this quiz show was a Morris Minor. I really wanted a Morris Minor. I couldn't drive, but I'd learned to drive. And anyway, they asked this question, and I think I answered it, and it wasn't right or something. But I then was just like talking to myself, going, "Oh, for fuck's sake!" Blah, blah, blah. And I went, "Oh fuck!" And it was
live.
It was an OB. It was a live broadcast. Ooh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was really...
You were under your breath, for fuck's sake.
No, you could hear it. No, everyone was like, it was like, yeah.
Well, just so you know, you're allowed to swear on this one.
Because you can edit.
We keep the swearing in. We just put an explicit symbol on the episode.
Oh, I see.
Russell often just, you know, casually throws in an F-bomb.
I do swear a lot. I mean, Jesus. Well,
it's a sign of a really nice person if you swear, apparently.
Do you think?
Yeah. Is it shows intelligence.
Fuck, really?
You're very smart. How long did you work with Jürgen Teller for, or collaborate with him?
God, I mean, on and off over the years, do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, from my first shoot was with him for ID Magazine when I was like, I don't know, 19, 20. Yeah, we did some great shoots. I mean, like one of my favourite shoots was with Chris McMenemy for 032C Magazine. And that was a really great shoot. Because, you know, I wasn't styling at that point when I was sort of doing those last...
She was the avant-garde model that really pushed...
Yeah, well, she's got grey hair. And we went to shoot... I was obsessed with Carlo Mellino.
That's right.
Yeah, and I really wanted to do a shoot with Carlo Mellino. I kept on saying it, and he was, like, not really picking up on it. And then someone from 032C came to him and said, "We want to do a thing on Carlo Mellino." He goes, "I've heard this name before. Speak to Zoe about it." And then the guy who ran the magazine came to me, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm obsessed with Carlo Mellino. I really want to do a shoot in this house." So we went to do a shoot in the house, and the house is amazing. It's a house in Turin in Italy. And Carlo Mellino basically had this secret life. He was in, you know, he's an inventor. He made lots of sort of machinery and stuff, and he was a photographer, but secretly he took photographs in this apartment that no one went to, none of his friends, of women dressed quite scantily. And after his death, these photographs were unearthed.
Wow.
And the pictures, the photos are amazing. They're really, really beautiful.
Why did he keep them to himself?
It was just a kind of secret thing.
Project.
That he had with this house. And the house was beautiful, really amazingly decorated, very, very beautiful. And I heard about this, and I saw the books and everything, and I saw some of the prints. Someone I knew actually had some of the Polaroids, because they're Polaroids. And so I went to visit this house, and I just fell in love with it. And that's when I was like, we've got to do a shoot here. And no one had really shot there. And then someone had, but they'd all sort of copied what Mellino had done in the house.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I only saw those shoots afterwards, actually. It was all sort of girls with their legs crossed with, like, stockings on and stuff.
Like recreating?
Just recreating his kind of tableau. Do you know what I mean? And so we went there with Kirsten and... oh, it's Kirsten, Kristen. There's two models. I'm sorry, Kristen McMenemy. And just did this shoot that was really... like nothing had been done there before, do you know what I mean? And it was very visceral. She was naked a lot of the shoot. It snowed halfway through the shoot as well. It was really
bizarre. She was naked?
Yeah, she was out on the terrace and she was wearing these boots, and she just had this little sort of a zoot shawl on, and then she came back in. And the pictures are really amazing. That's one of my favourite shoots I've ever done. Do you know what I mean? There was something really different about it. And just because of the environment, the way... And you know, nothing was planned, do you know what I mean? It was all... I got stuff, like the day before I'd seen... 2 days before I'd seen Pam Hogg's show, and everything in it was just like, oh my God, I want that for this show. And it was perfect.
Wow.
And the pictures are just amazing. Do you know what I mean? They were really, I think it inspired a lot of people, the shoot. And they were, it wasn't a fashion shoot. It was, all the photos just looked like beautiful vignettes. You know what I mean? They were just things with.
Where are they now? If someone wanted to see these, where would you see it?
You'd have to go online 032C to look it up.
It is online, that whole shoot.
Because
I looked it up not long ago.
You can see that shoot online, and then maybe the ICA, because they sold one of the prints from.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. When he had an exhibition there, they sold one of the prints.
But that for me, you know, when you collaborated with Jürgen, that for me is pretty much the pinnacle of his work, because I think there's something about the soul of your vision as well in those images.
Well,
that for me, and it also when he photographed you, like there's pictures of you taken by him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Because you, and I know you don't really like having your picture taken, no. Being, you know, having spent time with you, but the photos he took of you are just incredible. I mean, and also you are a style icon in many ways, and I know you might not be a mainstream style icon in the sense that everyone knows your name on the street, like if you think of Kate Moss or Naomi Campbell or whoever, like they're recognisable names. But if you ask anybody, like, who is the most stylish person in London, they always say Zoe Bedoe, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Without doubt. And I know that when we're all long gone, you will be remembered, you know, for the way that you have, you know, dressed and just your style.
World, yeah.
You're like
yeah.
a timeless, incredible human being. But the photos he took of you are just, like, next level.
Yeah, no, there's some interesting...
You in the roller skates and, like...
Oh, yeah, and the banana and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Where's the
yeah.
banana?
Oh, I'm eating a banana.
Did he even shoot that Missoni? Was it a Missoni?
Oh, the Missoni. I never saw those pictures.
Did he shoot that?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, because those photos, I mean, you just look absolutely...
Do you have a website?
No, darling.
You don't do that.
No, but I love that, like, because you're just...
I don't have a website. I mean, life is... I've got so much going on, babe. I've got time. Instagram, websites, so all these things.
Have you worked with any of the controversial photographers, like... Testino, for example.
Well, he photographed you once as a group, didn't he, with Tracy Emin?
Oh, yeah, the one at the National Portrait Gallery.
National Portrait Gallery, yeah.
He actually took a photo.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really you collaborating with him. That was you just being documented.
No, yeah.
No.
That was not my kind of... I mean, it's not my genre, do you know what I mean? The photographers and stuff. I mean, you know, I worked with a few people and it was, you know, mainly because of Jürgen, because we went back so far with the sort of... stuff that we'd done in the early days that I kind of, when I came back out doing stuff, you know, he'd asked me, it was like I was just down in the country writing poetry, do you know what I mean? And then he came down to shoot me for Self Service magazine with Jane Howe.
Oh,
he did like a 30-page story on me.
Wow.
And that was how we came back together and then we started to work together again. It was like bizarre. They did, it was a massive story in Self Service that they then had giant-sized photos in Colette in Paris
yeah.
of that shoot. That was the roller skates. That's where that's from.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's me and the girls in the garden. It's like, I just come back from Jamaica. Do you know what I mean? It was a mad shoot, and they did it for 2 days. But that's how we kind of came back together, and then I did some Marc Jacobs shoots with him and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They were so iconic, the Marc Jacobs. That became
such... I did a few of those.
Wow.
I did a few of those.
I loved those.
Yeah, there's some... Yeah, we...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
And more recently, you've actually collaborated with another kind of artist photographer, Tim Walker, and he shot you for the Pirelli calendar last year.
He shot me for Pirelli. I was the hooker smoking caterpillar.
It's such a great
photograph.
An amazing photographer. And he's an amazing photographer.
He is an amazing photographer, and he really is an artist. Yeah, I mean, he's come from the world of fashion. You know, it's a similar thing in a way to Jürgen in the sense that you see his work often in fashion magazines. But later this year, there'll be a retrospective of his work at the V&A, and that will include a shoot that you just did for that exhibition.
Yeah, exactly. Which was just in Italian Vogue. It's called Chasing the Dragon.
Because
the shoot is basically about objects that he's taken from the collection, the V&A collection, sort of curated and based a shoot around that piece.
Yeah.
And so with our...
That's a drug connotation, Chasing the Dragon,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's heroin, yeah.
So how does that relate to the V&A collection?
Because I tell you now, this box has dragons on it. It's like a little secret garden in it. And in the photo, when he sent me the picture, it was of a dragon in a garden. The dragon is almost like a dog. It's like a pet in the garden. That's kind of how we, you know, I said, like, oh, I love the dragon. It's like a pet. It's in this secret garden. And so that was the starting point for the shoot. And Shona Heath did this amazing set, which was sort of iridescent and glowed in the dark. And we had two amazing models that were just fantastic. Amazing hair and makeup. You know, Malcolm Edwards did the hair, and Is She Hungry did the makeup. Is She Hungry does all the kind of weird prosthetics for Bjork.
Yeah.
All those weird prosthetics you've seen. Yeah. Is She Hungry.
And actually, I think Tim made a video recently. With
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, he's been collaborating with her.
And the makeup, this guy, I mean, just phenomenal. Yeah. And the shoot was just next level. And we shot it for one magazine. It went to Italian Vogue.
Yeah,
which is really was it's where it should have been.
It's home,
you know, and that's going to go in the V&A.
And now, because basically that's all these shoots that he's did were for the V&A, but they were done paid for through magazines.
Wow.
Yeah. They're very elaborate shoots. Yeah, lots of.
And I just think the photography and the way you styled that shoot is transcendent.
But again, let's talk about that shoot in the sense that, you know, if you look at those that shoot, there are no credits. There are no credits. I mean, I was getting stuff in from, you know, some student who just finished at St. Martin's, flying his stuff, and he'd moved back to LA and he'd made these amazing bodysuits. So mainly everyone I used in there were students, and I was just like, you know
what? Yeah, they were like unknown designers.
This is what it's about for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to show people who are doing stuff that I think is really brilliant, really creative. I look through tons of fashion shoots. There was nothing I wanted to use. At the end of the day, even the thing, if there was something available, it wasn't available. I had to get something else. If I had to have relied on stuff that was going to be sent to me, we wouldn't have had a shoot. I would have had like sort of mad puffer jackets. I mean, it was just crazy.
And it seems so mad to me that like fashion magazines now, they only want to have like a page for Prada, a page for Gucci, a page for whatever. When actually, surely the whole point of fashion is that it's meant to be new ideas and taking something from the past and making it new.
One designer said, we don't even lend for shoots anymore, only special events. So that told me where it's now going, where they're not even interested in magazines anymore because they're like kind of, you know, becoming dinosaurs.
But
it's all about the celebrities on the front row at things. I was thinking, what do you mean we're only lending for special events? What special event? Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't make sense. Yeah. But yeah, so that shoot for me, I loved because we gave a platform to totally unknown. And the stuff, whenever I showed people the pictures of, they'd be like, where's that outfit from? I'm like, darling, it's like some kid who's just left school. Amazing stuff.
So will they get credited at the V&A?
They'll get credited. They got credited in Italian Vogue.
I know, but that's what's so great. It's like, you know, that's by choosing those people, though, you took them to Italian Vogue. I mean, how brilliant.
It's fantastic.
And have they continued these...
Well, I don't know because I don't really look at stuff outside of, I mean, I just found them for the shoot. And I mean, I'm sure, you know, people now look at them, be looking at them.
Yeah, of course.
The stuff, because the stuff was just fantastic. So, you know, but once I do the shoot, I mean, I don't look at clothes and fashion in that way. I'm just not interested. You know what I mean? I love clothes and I love style, but I don't have that kind of hungry energy to be checking on shows or I'm just not interested. It doesn't interest me. But, you know, if that design, I've had to do another shoot and I would then look back to that design and see what they're doing now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In context. But yeah, it was really amazing. And working with him was, we had a laugh because he'd only shot me before. He goes, it's so funny having you behind the scenes. He goes, it's giving him lots of lols. We just had a really good time, you know.
Didn't he shoot you for like a Lonvan advertising campaign?
He shot me for Lonvan as
and
well.
And wasn't it like you were like there it was like 15-year-old models and then Zoe and she looked younger than they did. I mean, it's like, you looked so beautiful in that campaign.
You looked stunning in those campaigns. I was like a whirling dervish. I was there till 9 o'clock, like spinning in like a cape with a hood. I mean, that was quite weird. But it was...
So you've worked with him on both sides of the camera.
Oh, but
yeah,
exactly.
Will the Pirelli images be in the show at the V&A?
No, that's just about the V&A collection.
Because I really want to see those in real life. I think those pictures of Naomi and P. Diddy and you and like...
I don't know. I think it's in the calendar.
Whoopi Goldberg did it as well, didn't she?
Yeah, Whoopi. I met her. Oh. She was fabulous. Oh, Whoopi. Yeah, great energy.
Oh, I'd love her to come on here.
Great vibration.
Whoopi's like such an icon.
She's fabulous. Oh. Really, really amazing.
Oh, I love her.
Great.
So recently you've been making a lot of art. You've been doing text pieces, like screen prints, which I actually have one of for my house. It's beautiful.
What?
I do. Russell's jealous now. Yes. You can get one. It's an edition. Okay. She's made this incredible text
stars
edition.
Are.
It's really great. And you've also been writing a book, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you are going to be in Somerset House very soon. You're going to have a room of your work in a major new exhibition called Get Up, Stand Up Now. And it's a show that's responding to and kind of celebrating, in a way, the issues and ideas within the work of photographer and filmmaker Horace Ove. And the show's exploring how successive generations of Black creatives have helped shape the cultural landscape of modern Britain and beyond.
So explain what you're going to be showing in that show.
So Zach Ove is Horace's son, yeah. Who's an artist.
And he's curating
artist.
The show.
Yeah, he's curating with Siri Hand. And they're looking at Horace's archival work. So Zach's always really loved all my sort of made work, you know, all the soft sculptures, and then he saw the film. And so that's what I've basically presented them with, the film, which is From the Mouth of Babes, Speak I, which is a text piece, and it's like a series of poems, which I'm doing like different series of films on. And so this piece will be in one room, and then I think I'm showing also the cape that I'm wearing. And
the
mask,
film.
And the mask that isn't in the film that is also made but relates to the film.
Did you make these as well?
Yeah, they're all made pieces by me. Yeah, so that's what I'm showing. And then,
but you class that as a soft sculpture?
Yeah, it's a soft sculpture in the sense that it's a wearable sculpture, and it's sort of three dimensional because it has these other masks on it. It has these other faces on the sculpt on the thing, and then the mask is a three dimensional piece. Which is an embroidery piece. And then I'm going to also have some text within the show as well.
Amazing. And actually, you were part of Rob Pruitt, the American artist. He did he does a flea market every so often. And there was a version of that at the Venice Biennale. And you were one of the invited guests.
I was doing a soft sculpture there.
Yeah, and you actually did it. It's almost like a performance of you.
Yeah, exactly. So I was doing a piece called There's Something About Louise. So I had acquired Louise Nevelson, amazing American artist. Sculpture, amazing. Mm-hmm. And
she's having her moment now. The last couple of years, people are starting to pay attention.
Yeah, but she had her moment even when she was dirt. She, you know, the work was going for a lot of money, and she was doing big works for big institutes and stuff. But she visually was arresting. I mean, she had an amazing look, and she wore like about, I don't know, 10 sets of eyelashes in one session. Mm. She had these amazing kind of eyelashes. And so I bought her from her estate, I bought her collection of eyelashes. So I got I don't know how many pairs of mink eyelashes. So I basically have made this jacket, which is reconfigured, so it then becomes a mink jacket. It's an old Victorian jacket that's covered in eyelashes.
And you hand sewed all those eyelashes.
They're all hand put on.
So during the Rob Pruitt flea market, she was actually there.
I was actually making this piece.
It's almost like a performance.
Louise. So it was a performance in itself, and people loved. They loved watching that, and they loved the fact that, you know, because when you look at it, it doesn't look like eyelashes. You can't, and it's kind of turned into another piece. Like, I've got two names for it. It's called There's Something About Louise because they're Louise's eyelashes, but it's also Venus flytrap. It looks like a Venus flytrap because the eyelashes open up, and just the way I've positioned them, it creates this kind of really weird kind
organic-y
of yeah it looks like a, yeah, it's kind of got another life as well, but at the same time this original piece has been reconfigured. It becomes a mink jacket because the eyelashes are made of mink. They're mink eyelashes. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and it's kind of hard for me because like something like that I don't even want to sell, you know what I mean?
Did you feel about making it and having people staring at you while you was working?
It was fine because they were just talking, we could walk around me, it was nice. I was chatting away to people.
Nice.
There were some really interesting people. I met a guy from Scotland who actually made some carpets, Louise Nevelson carpets or something. It was really interesting. Yeah, he'd done a tapestry and a carpet, he said, and it was just, and I'd never know she did that kind of work. And so he was really interested and interesting to talk to. So yeah, that was good working. I mean, I'm quite a private person, and so for me to do that, it's quite good. I sometimes do things like that to just push myself out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But I don't like when people talk about the performances. Like, I like doing them for film, and that's a way that I mean, you probably understand this a lot, you know, when you do something from stage or, you know, if you're doing a movie, it's very different. I mean, when I'm doing a film or making a film of myself, I can really be what I want to be in that sense of, because I'm not self-conscious. When I'm having to perform in front of people, I find it, it's not even like I'm nervous even, I just find that I can't. You know, it's like, you know, the masked man tells the truth. You know what I mean? Behind the mask, I feel like I can totally let everything go. And people, you know, like these kids came up to me recently. I did a performance 2 weeks ago and it was really interesting. They were like 7 and 9 and I was completely veiled. And they were just so taken with this image. And they said to me, why can't we see you? And I just said, you know what? For me, because people really tap into and respond to the way I look, which is not a great part of my personality as who I am in a sense, but it is for them from an objective point of view. When people visually see me, they tap into that visual. Do you know what I'm saying? And so when I do a performance, which is rare, I don't want someone to tap into that visual. Mm. I want to dissolve the body. I want to dissolve Zoe, because my text is about bridging realms and taking you to another place. So if that's what it's about and you are to receive that, you're not going to receive that looking at Zoe Beddoe, because Zoe Beddoe is a distraction, because you're like, oh, I like that. Oh, I like her. Oh, I have all the jewellery or whatever. It's not about that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm, and that's why it's like, you know, heard but not seen.
And this performance...
And powerful to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That you get to hear me, but you don't get to see me. But you do get to see me, because you are actually getting the quintessence of actually who
your
I
soul,
am.
Your
actually
soul.
The real me, yeah. Without all the other stuff that you think is like, oh, isn't it fabulous? It's like, who gives a fuck?
And this this performance you're talking about, where the kids came and spoke to you afterwards, was in Marrakesh, you've been spending a lot of time recently.
Exactly.
And it was part of the art fair there, wasn't it?
Yeah, the art fair there.
Yeah, the Marrakesh art
fair. And these kids were like, the first thing they said to me, they said, how, they don't speak English, but someone was translating one of the poems, because at the end of it, I say, children of the stars, you are the ones, shine, shine, shine. And they came to me, they said to the woman, they were saying, well, how does she know we're the children of the stars? How does she know? How does she know? And they came to me and they said, how did you know? She goes, do you know our future? I went, no, but you do. And they were like, they were amazing, these kids. Mm. I'm going to do like a workshop with them to invite them, teach them some English and do a poem with them.
Wow.
Teach them to write a poem and like do a little workshop. They were amazing, because what was amazing, I saw them the following evening. They came to a party and they walked in with their mother. And I said, hey, how are you doing? And the mum said hi to me and they just went hi. And the mum went, she goes, the mum recognised my voice because she never saw me either. And she looked at me and she said, poésie. Which is French for poet.
Yeah.
And they threw their arms around
me. Oh, my God.
Wow, Zoe.
I'm really emotional.
They were like, oh, my God. They were like...
She's the
poet. When they just saw me, they just said, hi, it's just another person. And then they realised who it was. They were like, oh, my God.
That's going to stay with them forever. You know that.
They made it for me. Because it was a very difficult performance. I did it in art.
I know. Well, we were talking.
Nightmares.
We were talking.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And the thing I found so incredible about that, and what I really like about these, I've seen a performance by you recently. I'm so happy you're doing them as well. But you do.
So hang on, you're doing this performance at Somerset House.
I'm going to do a performance at Somerset
House. Yes, of that.
I will. Of
Children of the Stars.
Yeah, that will be in it. From the mouth of Babe Speak I. So that's basically a body of work, which is, so I say, on autonomy, on the quintessence of who we are. On hypocrisy, on hegemony. You know, there are lots of poems on different things, on love, on love. You know
when
what
is
I mean?
This? When is the date of this?
So that's going to be in June.
Okay.
So the film that they're going to be showing is just like one of the poems that they're going to be showing as a film. And then I'm going to do a performance.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Which is, I don't really like doing performances, but I'm doing more of them. And in the sense that, you know, I'm always veiled, you don't see me. But I kind of, and then I'll do a talk afterwards with the thing.
And with the veil on still in the talk, or will you take it?
Well, I might do a talk later on in the show, right? Because it's on for 2 months. I might do a talk with someone that I invite on the panel.
Mm. Wow.
Which I'm thinking about who, but I might do,
Probably us.
Exactly.
The first one that I actually saw, I mean, I've seen the video, obviously. I remember you making the video.
Yeah, exactly.
But the first one that I actually experienced myself was at Shoreditch Church in London, very recently, like just in the summer. And I was blown away by it, though. And it was something like, so that whole architecture of that building was so strange. But you were veiled
there. Church. Yeah, I was veiled.
And it was almost like you weren't on stage. It was,
Behind a lectern.
Spiritual. Yeah, she was behind
a
lectern.
A lectern of an eagle, which was amazing. Yeah. I want a lectern. Anyone who's got an eagle lectern out there, I want one, because it was amazing, because I'm veiled and you couldn't see me. So what was really weird, when people came in, it was dark, so because I was completely in black.
And you're already there.
And
you were standing on stage when we walked in.
I was already meditating on stage, so you couldn't see me. And so people didn't know I was there. So when people's eyes adjusted, they realised there was a figure on the stage.
Oh, yeah. God.
And then all you saw was this eagle. I was behind the eagle, the lectern. And all you saw was these wings and the top of my head. And behind me, I was absolutely in line with the cross at the back. So it was very eerie. It was super eerie for people. Yeah. They were quite kind of freaked out.
I almost cried during that performance.
He
it was so moving.
I had a child.
Yeah.
because when I started, he said I sounded like a child, and he thought, oh great, she's taken to getting someone else performing.
Because I couldn't see who it was, I suddenly thought, oh maybe Zoe's not even on stage.
It was like a Sia moment.
I thought it was like somebody else, but actually it was like Zoe was sort of possessed or something by some other energy.
And everyone
energy
comes up to me
something.
After going, God, it doesn't sound like him. What do you mean? What do I sound like? What do you mean it doesn't sound like
it
me?
Was really unbelievable.
Reciting my own poetry, do you know what I mean? And you know, and people can't quite believe that I'm reciting with no words, because I don't write the poetry. I channel stuff in from my head, so it's always in my head first, and then I record it. I don't write. It's only now that I'm starting to write those poems out. I've never sat down to write anything.
Yeah,
it either comes or it doesn't. I can get a, you know, I can write something in my head, and then I'll get the first bit of it. Then later on in the bath, I'll get the end of it. So like for like Stars Are, for instance, I had the whole of Stars Are Black Bodies. And then by the end of the evening, I was in the bath and I just got, they radiate a light so bright, they blind those who choose not to see them. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, boom, it's like a download.
It's like channeling something.
Just,
yeah, amazing. Like
you know,
a download,
so
yeah.
For me, when people say, but how can you remember it all? I was like, because it's mine. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I wrote it. It's in my head, you know. So it's quite interesting for people when they come and there's so much material and I'm just sort of, you know, it's almost like trance, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can liken it to kind of, you know, because there is a shamanic element in the sense that I was meditating on stage and I'm like, how can you stay on there? You know, I just go into another zone with
You're very spiritual anyway, aren't you? You have access to that world, I would say.
Yeah, I just wrote a poem recently for in Marrakesh, and it's about, because I work at night. And it's interesting because people say, oh my God, you're up all night. You're just like a night bird. I'm like, yeah, but I can't work with interference. So for me, when everyone's gone to sleep, it's the coast is clear. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, and it's like when the clock strikes 12 and darkness reigns, my third eye opens, I straddle all planes. That's when I start to see. And it is that for me. You know, I feel that I have a clear vision. Do you know what I mean? I'm very much, then I'm, you know, I'm in
open.
All realms.
Yeah.
You know, I can access, you know, you get that in the book, you know, I'm accessing realms.
Yeah,
know?
So let's talk about the book. So you've recently just completed a book, and it's, how many pages is it? Like 48 or something?
I don't know. It's 14,000 words. It's not quite a novella. It's like a novelette, I think you'd call something like that.
Okay, yeah. And it's when I read it, and Russell actually asked me this morning, because we both read it completely yesterday, and it's called In Search of the Dodo Bird,
A
Meditation on Love by Zoe Bedeau. And this book feels to me, like knowing you, like a total true story. And Russell actually questioned that this morning. He was like, is this a fictional story? Is it a true story? Because it reads like it's a true story. And I said, well, I think it's a true story.
Yeah, it's
because
a true story.
It's so fantastical and so like spiritual and on so many different levels. It's just a fascinating novella or whatever. But I can't wait for you to publish this because I think it's really going to move a lot of people.
It's a story about you travelling abroad to find sources, pieces for a vintage shop that you used to have.
Yeah, exactly. And I find these gloves. And then it's basically about this journey that I embark on through working with these gloves. I worked on the gloves for a show in New York called Salon 94 that Duro Aloru curated and had done a couple of them, and he asked me to put them into the, he saw the gloves and asked them to me to put them in the show. But when I was working with the gloves, I often sometimes when I'm working with things, or a lot before, I used to work a lot in this realm with psychometry, is people giving me objects and I get information from the object. So if someone gives me a ring, I read the information that's encoded in that object.
Yeah.
And that's what psychometry is. And when I started to work on the gloves started to speak to me. And so this is the story about those gloves and that the journey of those gloves through me. So it's a very multi-layered story because it straddles many different timelines. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of information.
When will this be published?
I don't know. I've only just finished it, and I'm just trying to think about ways in which to because it's there's a performative aspect about it, so that I could do readings and do it as like a little play. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or I was thinking maybe doing a podcast. I mean, it has to be a book as well, where, you know, people have got, you know, the ephemera, they can physically.
I must say that having read it yesterday, it's very alive.
Yeah.
I mean, the text is very, it's as if you are talking.
It's very performative.
Yeah, you know, people say they can hear
you
me
talking.
Yeah.
Which, everyone who's read
funnily
it
enough,
right,
like in the book, there is this whole thing where you are the only person that can open this book that comes with the gloves when you bought them at this auction.
The story,
you're the only person that can see the story. When other people open the book, it wouldn't open.
They can't see anything.
They couldn't open it, or they can't see anything. And I loved that. But actually, it felt like you were talking to me. I found it quite a connected experience being the reader.
I think you need to record it like an audiobook.
I think you should be the one reading it.
And then
as well.
We link it from TalkUp.
Yeah, that would be great, actually. Yeah, it'd be great to be linked to something.
I think
people are going to want to read this story. It's fascinating. It's amazing.
And I think what's really fascinating about the story is the story...
But it is true. It's not fiction.
No, it's not fiction. And you can see the truth in the story.
Well, that's what I mean. It feels so real.
The story comes to the Frieze Gallery.
It goes to Frieze Masters Art Fair.
Frieze Masters Art Fair 4 years ago, the Robin Brown.
Wasn't I with you then?
No, you weren't with me, but you...
Was I on my booth?
You on your booth.
But didn't we have like lunch or something with one of your daughters? I swear.
We hung out
that day.
And then I went.
Where was I?
And I knew that I had to.
You were in America.
There was something that had to be done, and you know, and this was, it was so. The Frieze Masters was the kind of encapsulates the story, and the story is there. It ends there, and it kind of, that's when you kind of, it all comes together when you're thinking, God, this is real. This happened.
And I think for me, that's why it was so extra freaky, because I was actually in Frieze Masters with you that day.
Yeah,
before
exactly.
I didn't see it or witness it.
Just to have that evidence, because the story is so fantastical. I don't even want to talk too much about.
No.
You know, not even here, but just in general, when people say, "Is it true?" You know, it's like, it's true. You have to take what, because it's so fantastical. So when you have something that is fantastical, there will always be a cognitive dissonance for you. As human beings, where we question the truth, you're just like, how is that possible?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like with anything, you know, anything that's kind of has a shock, it's like, what? They started talking. And it's like, so to have the evidence of the photographs at the end that within the Masters, had we not got those, it would still be in that kind of realm of like, oh, right, that never happened.
But instead it roots it, doesn't it, in something real, location.
And I think that ending is just... so great to have that, where it's just brilliant. Kind of, you know, okay, that was that.
And but we quite, need to get that out
it's
there,
quite emotional.
And also, it's an ending that doesn't end, because it continues.
It's kind of continues.
It's got this open
it's
end.
It's got an open end. It's
which
an
is
open
totally
end.
Genius.
It's got
and
an
I don't even
end.
Know, you know, we won't describe what happens, but the people who are involved in the future, you know, maybe
exactly.
still aren't even aware, or will be discovering it when the book gets published.
Exactly. Yeah. Their connection to the book.
And they'll
but
be the next
Can I tell you something that happened to me on the way back from the Rob Pruitt, right? I'm on the flight coming back from Venice to London, and I'm sat next to Norman Rosenthal.
No. And he curated the booth at Frieze Masters, which is
exactly.
involved in this
story.
And the story, everyone remembers this booth, it was The Collector,
exactly.
which was a kind of
Robin
created
Brown
environment.
Robin Brown.
And
I turn to him and I say, I've written a story and you're in it. And he said, oh, really? And we got chatting because we had a friend in common. We talked about the friend. And then when he got off the plane, he said to me, and what's your name again? I said, Zoe Betty. He goes, I'll be looking out for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really funny.
But even that, I'm sorry. That
in itself.
Even he
to be
appeared
sat
to you on
the... exactly.
All
after, that was after
this,
I did totally. When I told Shanti, who was with me when we did the thing, I was like, I was sat next to that guy who basically, she was like, you're joking. I goes, no, he sat next to me on the thing. We talked about the book. She's like, this is too fucking weird.
And this is going to be really frustrating for everyone listening.
I know.
I think having patience and, you know, taking time to do things is kind of what Zoe's taught.
Patience.
No, but I'm just telling you something.
Oh, okay.
It's what Zoe's taught me.
Oh.
Like, yeah, through spending time with Zoe, I've learned about that. And this idea that, you know, when I was making music and I was in my band, I always worried what people thought and all that kind of stuff. And what I love about Zoe is the fact that you've been so creative constantly for yourself. And like you say, you're your only judge and you're the only person that can validate you.
We have to be the arbiters.
Precisely. And that is what people need to remember and take from this. But I also think storytelling is such an amazing part of who you are. Mm. And I love coming to your house because you're an amazing chef as well. I
mean, yeah, you cook for me.
You're kind of a creative person on many different levels. But I love the fact that you invite people to your home, all different backgrounds, different creative industries, all this kind of thing, for conversation. And every time I've left
like
your dinners, I feel inspired.
Yeah, I love that.
And
breaking bread with people is exactly babe.
Yeah.
It's the ritual of, you know, and you really get to know when people say they know me. I know they've eaten with me, they've been in my home. That's, you know, people, you know, they get to know you in the real way.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, that thing of time, I always, you know, when people, I've never had this thing, I always think, you know, what's meant for you will never pass you by.
Yes.
And, you know, when you think you've lost something, nothing's ever lost, because you can lose something and get something 10 times better. And so for me, you're always on time. And it's so great. I've had so many weird situations when I've had to go back for something. And I think, oh, I was sent back to do that because now I then got this. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, once my ex-boyfriend, he held me back. He didn't get on. He was like pissing around. I was like, I need to get to town. I got on the bus and the bus driver goes, And congratulations, you are the 1,000th person to get on the bus today and you have won £1,000. I was like, what?
What?
He goes, you hold on to that ticket. And he goes, the person yesterday didn't claim. So, you know, it's gone to £1,000 now. And I was like, going, what is going on? And he's going, there's a thing on the ticket. And I phoned up and I'd won £1,000.
No.
And had my boyfriend not pissed around that morning, I would have got on the bus earlier and I wouldn't have been the 1,000th person. Weird. But I was meant to be 1,000 because there's a couple of things.
What did you do with that £1,000?
There was a thing that I wanted to buy in this flea market, which was this amazing old cabinet that I wanted to make an altar of, which I've got in my bedroom, and I bought that and it was quite expensive, so that went towards that. I actually had to share the £1,000 with this woman who came forward from a couple of days before. We split it £500 and I got a few bits and bobs, you know, little trinkets.
And you still got that altar.
Can I just say something? Yeah. Talking of lost and found,
yes, exactly.
When we came for dinner, Russell brought something to your house.
Rocky's food, my dog's food, is Lily's organic food, and every Pride they bring out a Pride range, and they sent
Gay Pride.
And they sent me cat food, but it was a gay pride cat food.
And you were like, I don't have a cat.
And Rob was like, well, Zoe's got a cat. And I was like, oh, great. I'm going for dinner at Zoe's. What an amazing gift. Cat food. Like, Pride cat food. Is there anything better by Lily's Organic? Turn up and I go, Zoe, this is for you. Pride cat food. And you're like, I haven't seen the cat for 2 years. I don't know where the cat is. And
the
I was
cat's like, oh, Misty pain. Has disappeared.
Painful. Well done, Rob.
I know,
I've just
Russell
reminded
like,
you of yeah. your lost cat.
You're exactly.
like,
yeah,
I'm mad about that cat. Mistopheles. Mistopheles.
What happened,
you kept
though,
the cat food in the cupboard.
The cat came back. The cat has been lost and found.
It's a crazy story because I even had him
food.
On this thing saying, you know, this company that finds your cat, they never found him quite clearly. And I told them recently, take him off the thing. He's now been found. And I was back from Marrakesh walking down the street one day, and I just thought to myself, say Misty just walk back in again, you know, it'd be so weird. 2 days later, Moon, my daughter, youngest daughter, is coming out of the tube. She walks at the bottom of my street. She calls me and she says, Misty is at the bottom of the street just hanging out on the pavement. I went, you're joking. She goes, come now with some cat food and and bring some treats and everything. And so I was like, oh my God, this is really... She's going, no. She goes, oh my God. He goes, the car just went by. He's run behind some gates. I goes, okay, grab him. So I came down and we saw him. He's just sitting there looking through these little bars at us and stuff. And I shook the treats and had the cat food. And he came out and I grabbed him. He was struggling all the way to home. We got home. And then he got home and he just relaxed. And he went to sleep for 2 days.
Where had he been? What journey
babe,
has
he's
he
been
living,
on? I don't know, but he's been living at the end of the street. Cats have been gone for 2 years. It's a long time and been living like literally there. He had the cat food. He loved the gay
pride. Did you give him the gay pride?
He loved the gay pride cat food.
He loved the gay pride.
It was all meant to be.
It was a highlight of his day.
He polished off the gay pride cat food.
But I mean, it's just very, very bizarre because this cat came to us in a very bizarre way. Moon called me. I was on holiday and she said, I found this cat in the park. I went, no way, you're not bringing a cat from the park. 2 days later, she sends me a picture going, got myself a kitty, and the cat was in her bedroom.
Amazing. Oh.
And she said she woke up that morning, the cat was on our doorstep.
No way.
Right? And she was obsessed by cats as a child.
Yeah.
And Mistopheles was her favourite. And this cat's got exactly the same masking. So she called him Magical Mr. Mistopheles. And he is like that. He's just of another. And he's still coming back and forward. He comes in. I'm there. He doesn't look at me anymore because I haven't been at the house. He's really pissed off. But he comes and eats still. He can barely fit through the cat flaps. He's been fed somewhere else for sure.
Yes.
He's huge and he's a greedy little effer. But he's still around, Mistopheles.
So funny. Well, good one. That's a really nice story. I love that story. So, Zoe, every episode of Talk Art, we ask our guests two questions.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
One is, what is your favourite colour?
Verdigris.
What the hell is that?
Verdigris.
It's okay, so you're going to look out for verdigris now. So, when you go out in the streets and you see like old churches and stuff, you know, you see a green top on something.
Oh yeah,
no.
That's verdigris.
What do you mean?
Like
green?
On the top, like, you know, on the top of a church, they used to make.
You mean like a metal colour?
Yeah, spires or metal, anything metal.
Yeah.
Over time, the natural patination will go green if it's been bronze, brass, or copper.
Copper, yeah.
So the weathering with sea air or just
the oxidisation of it.
Yeah, exactly. It creates this colour.
Wow.
And it's a really particular green that was used very much as a pigment up until the 19th century in sort of old Renaissance paintings. You see verdigris a lot, and they would have made it by acetic acid, putting it on copper plates. That's how they got the pigment then. But it is a natural patination. I love it because it's alchemical. It happens.
But it must be a man-made colour then, because it comes from metal.
It's nature creates it.
Because it's happening through the oxidisation of the metal.
Through metal.
But it wouldn't have been created if the human hadn't made the metal.
Yeah, but it's still, it's a natural patination that happens only through sea air and you know, the environment.
Right.
But often metal can come from the ground, though, can't it?
Metal comes from the ground.
Yeah,
metal's a natural thing.
So
they're
ores. Yeah, it's been cut up and controlled by a man, but it's
man-made.
Yeah, it's not man-made.
It's a natural occurrence. But when it was made as a pigment, it was made through acetic acid being put onto copper plates. That's how you got the pigment to then be used.
Wow.
But it's an amazing creature. So it's this brilliant green. Do you know what I mean?
Have you ever seen that in fashion or?
In clothes. I mean, it's a colour now that it's obviously made up. You know, so you can get, if you put verdigris, you'll get that colour, but it's not necessarily the exact verdigris. Because when it's from the metal, you really see it's a really incredible colour. But you'll notice it now on sort of buildings.
And do you stop and when you see it, like take it
in? I love the colour. I think it's amazing. Wow. It's a really great colour.
You're going to be really proud of me because I've got some garden lights in Margate for the garden that are that kind of effect.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So winning, I actually did that without even knowing.
You're incredible, Rob.
It's an interesting colour.
It's just hanging out with Zoe so much, it's just rubbed off.
It's made you want verdigris everywhere. Our second question is, if you had a art heist, what your touchstone artwork that you could steal without getting in trouble and live with forever, what would that be?
Any of Picasso's Harlequins. It would definitely have to have one of those in the living room. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Are any of them in any collections in the UK that you know that people can go and see?
No, I don't know of them being in any collections in the UK, actually.
I'll do a bit of research and then maybe...
Yeah. David Hockney did Harlequins as well, didn't he?
Yes, I'm sure there's some. He did.
In his younger years.
Yeah,
when
really?
Circus
that's
ones
nice.
With Harlequins.
No, you know what? I think they
Pieros.
Were for an opera or
they
a ballet
were down,
or something.
What's the opera
do you know,
down
weirdly,
south?
We had that as a poster when I was a kid at my house. My mum.
What
had
are we talking about? I've got the poster. I've got the poster. Someone
yeah,
gave it
doing
to
like
me.
A cartwheel
doing the cut. They're standing up.
Yes.
I've got the original poster
no
that someone gave to me when I had my shop. My shop was called Harlequin in Brighton.
Yeah.
And someone brought it into me because they knew I loved Harlequins. I've got the original poster. Yeah, it's fabulous. Yeah. I've got the original poster.
It's Glyndebourne. An opera, was it that
Glyndebourne?
Yeah,
maybe it was.
Glyndebourne.
Because my mum loved Glyndebourne when I was growing up.
Sussex, yeah.
And in your flat, you actually live with so many great artworks. And you were the first person that told me about John Sheehy.
Oh, I love John
who
Sheehy.
Then had a show at Studio Voltaire.
Yeah, and there's, yeah.
Much later, really,
yeah,
you've got a few
I've
of
got,
his
I've
work.
Got quite a lot of his work,
I remember
yeah.
you calling me when you discovered him and you were so excited.
He's fantastic. He's a poet as well.
He's amazing.
And he's just brilliant, you know, and he's come through the kind of... The shop that I found him through was the shop that supports people that have kind of mental health issues in the community. Mm. And they kind of harness, you know, their creativity through doing workshops and they make stuff for the shop. And it's really amazing. It's called Outpost on the Holloway Road.
That's great.
And that's how I just think it's so brilliant. This guy has been just, again, a maker who wasn't looking to be discovered. He's just making work.
Yeah.
It's what he does.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? He writes. He's amazing, amazing guy. And I just had all the stuff framed, actually. I've got to go and pick it up. I'm really looking forward to getting all that stuff on the wall.
I also really love that painting in your hallway by Lynette Yadin-Boachi.
Yeah, that's
such
beautiful.
A beautiful.
I had that for
portrait.
Years before I put it up. It's so crazy that I just...
It's painted so
it blue.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. And she does few paintings of women, and it's a really beautiful because it's really dark, and you just got to see the corner. There's just this little streak of red. It's beautiful.
I hope you've insured that now.
Russell's going to be so jealous of that.
I haven't insured that, actually. I need to.
Russell's going to be so jealous of that one because he's so obsessed with Lynette.
Oh, yeah, no, she's amazing. Obsessed. The new show as well was fantastic.
And Toya and Oji Odutola, who's their friends, aren't they? And her work as well, which is very figurative.
Well, we all had dinner with her.
I did have dinner, but I met her
before. Okay.
Yeah.
She's lovely, yeah.
Really, really good. So, nice. Some nice.
And Lynette's got a show coming up at the Tate that's just been announced.
The Tate?
Oh, she? Great.
May 2020. She's
I
got
didn't
a Tate
know that.
Retrospective.
Oh, my God.
A retrospective,
amazing.
But she's so young.
Yep.
More a mid-career survey.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
wrong.
A retrospective. She's like 40 or 35 or something.
Yeah.
She's really young.
David Strigley had a retrospective.
I know. But I love Lynette. Oh,
I know.
What
an
amazing.
Really,
yeah, so
that's amazing.
May 2020.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
really
exciting.
Yeah, maybe your work could be loaned for it.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Or maybe you're going to get your own show at the Tate one day, because I think you will.
Yes, I do too.
Well, everybody, we will be inviting Zoe back when she curates the show in Margate, because that is a whole other episode.
And hopefully
it's the
we can link
incredible
out,
thing.
We'll
and
link
by then
the,
we can link up the whole dodo bird.
Exactly.
But yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Zoe.
Real
what an
pleasure,
amazing
guys.
Show.
That was really nice, and I hope you get some nice stuff out of it you can edit out of it, because I'm sure all of it is not
I don't
usable.
Think, no,
it's
really, actually, I don't think we're going to have to edit. Weirdly, the last few episodes we've done, we haven't had to edit at all, because we're getting better at it.
We can edit that out.
But honestly, you guys really could have a show. Like,
we
I
have
mean,
got a show.
No, I know you've got a show. But
this is it.
Where you're actually seeing physically, like, yeah, I don't watch TV, I haven't had telly in 30 years, but... I would like to watch you on television.
Oh, thanks.
No, but when you first started, I was like, oh my God, the band is so professional. It's really a real nice little, you know, thing going on. Hinge and Bracket.
It is Hinge. We are Hinge. Who's Hinge? Who's the Bracket?
Let's not go there. So everybody listening, you can find images of all the artworks we've discussed today on @talkart.
Oh, are you on Instagram?
No.
Okay, fine.
We will be back.
Well, I am. You know what? I am on Instagram. I mean, I'm physically there, but I don't go on there very often. But
no, you post like once a year.
I post once a year.
What's your Instagram name?
I think it's @ZoeBadeau, isn't it?
My name. Yeah, all hail.
Anyway, all hail Zoe Badeau. We will be linking to that on our Instagram @talkart. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening,
guys.
We
will be back soon.
Love you.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram @talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.